This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I'm going to read some pages that I've been working on since last fall, and the pages belong to this ongoing effort to think about the relations among images, memory, history, death, mourning. And I began writing these pages in response to a question around which Gatu Spivak organized a conference last October at Columbia University. And it was a conference entitled, What Is It to Read? And a number of us were invited to respond to that question. And it was actually called, What Is It to Read? Thinking with Jacques Derrida. And we each gave talks, and then he responded. And what I had decided is that I would try and think about what it would mean to read an image. So much of this talk is actually a meditation, not just on these particular images, but also in general what it means to read. And I was guided in this effort by two statements, I think. And the first one is a statement by Emerson that he makes in a journal entry. And he just says, reading is quotation. And the second statement is a statement that I think many of you probably know, a statement by Benjamin, when in a fragment he just says that in writing we practice the art of citation without citation marks. And so that what I tried to do in these pages was to seek to enact, in accordance with these two protocols, what it might mean to read in general, but also what it might mean for me to read. And I think that this enactment is legible in the sort of citationality of the talk, which I think many of you will recognize, but also in other ways in which I think will be made clear in the talk. The talk is called Palm Reading, Fazıl Şek's Handbook of Death, and I'll just start. There can be no image that is not about destruction and survival, and this is especially the case in the image of the dead. We might even say that the image of the dead tells us what is true of every image, that it bears witness to the enigmatic relation between death and survival, loss and life, destruction and preservation, mourning and memory. It also tells us, if it can tell us anything at all, that what dies is lost and mourned within the image, even as it survives, lives on, and struggles to exist, is the image itself. This is why the image of death, again speaking for all images, so often speaks of the death, if not the impossibility, of the image. It announces the inability of the image to tell a story, the story of death, for example. It is because of this silence in the face of loss and catastrophe, even when death remains undeclared, that the image is always at the same time an image of death, an image about the death of the image, about the ruin of the image's capacity to show, to represent, to address and evoke the persons, events, things, truths, histories, lives, and deaths to which it would refer. This is why we might say the entire logic of the world can be read here, and it can be read as the logic of the image. Like the world, the image allows itself to be experienced only as what withdraws from experience. Its experience, and if it were different, it would not be an experience at all, is an experience of the impossibility of experience. The image tells us that it is with loss and death that we have to live. Nevertheless, what makes the image an image is its capacity to bear the traces of what it cannot show, to go on in the face of this loss and death, to suggest and gesture toward its potential for speaking. In other words, the fact of the image's existence, and here I refer only to an image worthy of the name image, to an image that would remain faithful to the deadly silences that make it what it is, overcomes the death about which all images speak, or at least seek to speak. The image, then, this means of death, composed of death, belonging to death, taking its point of departure from death, seeking to speak of death, and not only its own, but also the death of death, the emergence and survival of an image that will that telling us it can no longer show anything, nevertheless shows and bears witness to what history has silenced, to what no longer here and arising from the darkest nights of memory, haunts us and encourages us to remember the deaths and losses for which we remain still today responsible. One, what would it mean to assume responsibility for an image or a history, for an image of history or for the history sealed within an image? How can we respond, for example, to the images and histories inscribed within these two photographs? How can we begin to read them? And especially when the borders and the distinctions that would guarantee our understanding of them have been shattered by a history of violence and death from which no determination can be sheltered. In exhibiting and archivizing the image of one who is no longer here, in the one instance, a child killed in the Soviet bombardment of Afghanistan, and in the other, a brother killed in the 1988 battle for control of the Mazur-Kabul Road, but also the hand of the one who holds and offers the image, the father and brother, who in the moment of which we are now viewing the image, may no longer be alive. The images remain bound to the survival of the traces of a past and to our ability to read these traces as traces. They belong to a series of photographs taken by the New York-born photographer Fazl Sheikh in the winter of 1997 in Afghan refugee camps in northeastern Pakistan and in several cities in Afghanistan, including Kabul and Jalalabad. In particular, they belong to a series of photographs of hands, simply hands, holding small photographs of lost fathers, sons, and brothers. They also belong to Fazl Sheikh's ongoing effort during the last 10 years to document and record the resulting mass phenomena of the refugee in Afghanistan and Pakistan, but also in Somalia, Kenya, and beyond. The photographs were taken after the Taliban's capture of Kabul in 1996 and after the series of prohibitions it proclaimed against images, pictures, and portraits in December of that year. They were taken in refugee camps among the Northern Alliance in the secrecy of night and under the light of a small lamp, and they are meant to remember and memorialize the deaths of loved ones, and indeed to remember and memorialize an earlier act of remembrance and memorialization, since they are, after all, and among other things, photographs of photographs. They are meant to remind us of the violent history that led to these deaths, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979, which precipitated a long and bloody history of displacement, civil strife, and struggle for control of the country, the efforts by the CIA and Pakistan's ISI, Inter-Services Intelligence, to support Afghan resistance to the Soviets and expand it into a holy war, and Islamic Jihad, which would turn Muslim countries within the Soviet Union against the communist regime and eventually destabilize it, the devastation of Afghanistan during the 10 years before the Soviet Union's withdrawal in 1989, the fact that by 1990, almost half of the Afghan population, 6.2 million, had fled the country, the civil wars and the eventual emergence of the Taliban's reign of terror in the early to mid-1990s, and by the winter of 1997, with 2.7 million Afghans still living in exile and nearly 2 million Afghans dead in the period after the Soviet invasion, the reduction of a country to a landscape which everywhere bears the traces of dispossession, destruction, and death. The images also are meant to evoke, in however an encrypted manner, the long history of invasion, colonization, and violence that has defined, shaped, and divided Afghanistan for several centuries, and the deaths that this history has produced in the past, but also, as we know all too well, in the present and in the future. They also call forth important questions about the relation between Islam and the long history of the prohibition of images, the relation between Islam and photography, technology, and modernization, the relations among the practice of palm reading, the Islamic belief in the evil eye, and the importance of the hand and its five fingers within the Quran, but also as a prophylactic against this evil eye. And finally, they also bear witness to the force of decontextualization that takes place in every photograph and that thereby enables us to suggest something about the nature of photography in general. These are photographs, in other words, that not only tell us something about the moment in which they were taken and about the several histories that are sealed within that moment, but also about the structure and character of photography itself. To read these photographs, therefore, means to give an account of the several histories and contexts sealed within them, but also to think about what memory can be when it seeks to remember the trauma of violence and loss, of dispossession and death. But how can we respond to what is not presently visible, to what can never be seen within the image? If the structure of an image is defined as what remains inaccessible to visualization, this withholding and withdrawing structure prevents us from experiencing the image in its entirety. It encourages us to recognize that the image, bearing, as it always does, several memories at once, is never closed. 2. If these two photographs evoke a history of crisis, loss, and destruction, then, part of what is placed in crisis is the finitude of the context within which we might read them. This is why, if we respond to them by trying to establish only the historical context in which they were produced, we risk forgetting the disappearance of context, the essential decontextualization that is enacted by every photograph. Like the severed hands that hold these little memorials of loss and death, the moment in the image appears suspended and torn from any particular historical moment, past, present, or future. It is in this highly unstable and dangerous relationship between violence and nonviolence that responsibilities form, responsibilities that have everything to do with how we read these two extraordinary photographs. Benjamin refers to the violence or nonviolence of reading when he claims that the image that is read, which is to say, the image in the now of its recognizability, bears to the highest degree the imprint of the perilous critical moment on which all reading is founded, end quote. Suggesting that there can be no reading of an image that does not expose us to a danger, he warns us of the danger of believing that we have seen or understood an image. For Benjamin, the activity of reading is charged with an explosive power that blasts the image to be read from its context. This tearing or breaking force is not an accidental predicate of reading. It belongs to its very structure. 3. Let us return to these two hands and to the images they seem to offer to us. What these two photographs say to us in all their muteness, in all their silence, in their several relations to death, memory, mourning, and transmission, is that if there is a thought of the hand or a hand of thought, it is not of the order of conceptual grasping. These photographs do not represent the act of a comprehension that begins by taking hold of something, by laying one's hand on something. Instead, the hands in these images barely seem to hold the small photographs that lay in their palms. The image of the dead child almost seems to be floating, suspended like the hand that holds it, but it holds it lightly, barely supporting the image with two of its five fingers, each of which points in a different direction, as if to suggest, however discreetly, the mobility of reference that structures every photograph. The entire photograph is touched by a kind of fragility and vulnerability, by a sense of surrender and evanescence, all of which also are legible in the photograph of the brother's hand holding the image of his dead sibling, and especially in the hand's disappearing, withdrawing fingers. In both instances, the thought of the hand offered here is one of a hand that gives, that offers, that holds, if this is possible, without taking hold of anything. If these two photographs therefore suggest the fragility, uncertainty, and indetermination from which any act of understanding emerges, they also inscribe within the limits and contours of their permeable frames an allegory of photography. The hands that extend themselves, that seek to keep and to hold, to carry and hand over, to hand down like a kind of legacy or inheritance, a fragment of the past, these hands tell us what a photograph desires. It too wishes to offer, to keep, to convey and hand over a fragment of our memory. Like the hand, it comes to us as a mode of transmission, but a mode of transmission that asks us to think about what it means to transmit or communicate, to bequeath something, to leave behind a legacy or inheritance through which a future might become possible. The photographs are about, among so many other things, what it means to pass something down, to hand something over, a memory, a death, a past, present, or future. And not only because they confirm, in however an interrupted manner, a story of inheritance and lineage, a story of the relations among fathers, sons, and brothers. Emphasizing the singularity of a single death, and we should never forget that what is ineffaceable about death is that no matter how many thousands, hundreds of thousands, or even millions of deaths there may be, these deaths are each time singular deaths. They also suggest that, like photography itself, inheritance is both a matter of singularity and repetition. a matter of the singularity of a memory and of the repetition without which there could be neither memory nor inheritance. This association between inheritance and photography also suggests that what these hands surrender to us is what is given to us by every photograph, an image. We can never remind ourselves enough that the photograph gives us an image rather than what is photographed. We could even say that every photograph turns the photographed into a kind of refugee, tearing it from its context and displacing it to another place and moment. In these two photographs, what is torn from its context is not simply the hand that offers the photograph of a dead son or a dead brother, the act of memory and memorialization itself, but also the innumerable other deaths evoked by these singular deaths. That the small photographs evoke the son's and brother's absence tells us that the photographs, the ones before us, but also the ones held in the father's and brother's hands, come to us as all photographs do in the mode of bereavement. Moreover, we know that once the other dies, the dead one can only survive in us as an image. At the same time, and this is part of the force of these two photographs, and especially that of the dead child, when we look at the dead who have been incorporated as images in us, we are looked at by them. We need only look again at the two images before us. The dead child looks directly at us, and even the half-blind dead brother still looks at us with his remaining eye. If we are looked at by them, however, there is no symmetry between the interplay of gazes that takes place here, which is why what is at stake in viewing these images is also our responsibility toward them. In looking at us, the dead asks us to remain answerable for them, to think of our relation to what brought death to them. That photographs therefore ask us to think simultaneously of the relations among the past, the present, and the future is confirmed by the deadly fact that we can no longer view these two photographs without also being asked to think about the death and devastation that has been visited upon Afghanistan and its peoples for the last 17 months, and that will no doubt continue into the future. This is why we might say these photographs of hands that bear images of the dead in their palms offer us traces of the past from which we also may read the future. They tell us that all reading is perhaps a kind of palm reading, but a palm reading that, like the reading of these two palms and of the small images that cover part of the palms to which they now belong, reveals an encounter with the death that defines the horizon of the future, and not only ours. 4. As Gershom Scholem notes in one of the several texts he wrote on chiromancy, the determination of a man's character and frequently of his fate and future from lines and other marks on the palm and fingers was one of the mantic arts which developed in the Near East, apparently during the Hellenistic period. In the Middle Ages, he goes on to say, the Christian chiromantics found a scriptural basis for chiromancy in the book of Job. He sealeth up the hand of every man that all men may know his work, which could be interpreted to mean that the hand imprints are made by God for the purpose of chiromancy, end quote. Turning to the Arabic roots of palmistry, Scholem traces the history of the belief that the hand is a kind of book, a kind of guide or handbook to the generations of man, to the way in which events leave their historical traces on bodies, the way in which the past informs and survives in the present, and the way in which the future can be read from the trace of the lines in the hand's palm. Within this history, the palm is viewed as the most elementary part of the hand and as the source from which the fingers are developed. The hand is related to the expression of thought in language and writing, and because the form, the texture, the lines, and the gestures executed subconsciously by the hand are unlike the expression of the face, beyond our control, they are understood to possess the virtue of impartiality. The hand is understood to have a privileged relation to reading and writing, and for the blind, the touch of the hand is the sole means of reading. The hands are even said to be the eyes of the blind. The practice of palm reading therefore bears within it another thought of the hand, but one that, with its emphasis on, among other things, the lines of life, destiny, knowledge, and death, brings together several of the issues with which I'm concerned tonight. The close relations between life and death, reading and inheritance, memory and inscription, uncertainty and testimony, sight and responsibility, and among the past, the present, and the future. These motifs are analyzed in Benjamin's strange and difficult 1919 essay, Fate and Character. There, in the context of a reconsideration of the relations and differences between fate and character, Benjamin seeks to provide a theory of reading in general. Quote, contemporary ideas do not permit immediate logical access to the idea of fate, he writes, and therefore modern men accept the idea of reading character from, for example, the physical features of a person, finding knowledge of character as such somehow generally present within themselves, whereas the notion of analogously reading a person's fate from the lines in his hand seems unacceptable. This seems as impossible as predicting the future. For under this category of foretelling the fate is unceremoniously subsumed. The fate is unceremoniously subsumed, while character appears as something existing in the present and the past, and therefore as perceptible. It is, however, precisely the contention of those who profess to predict men's fate from no matter what signs that for those able to perceive it, who find an immediate knowledge of fate as such in themselves, it is in some way present, or, to put this more cautiously, accessible. The supposition that some accessibility of future fate contradicts neither that concept itself nor the human powers of perception predicting it is not, as can be shown, nonsensical. Like character, fate too can be apprehended only through signs, not in itself. For even if this or that character trait, this or that link of fate, is directly in view, these concepts nevertheless signify a relationship, one that is never accessible except through signs, end quote. The complete elucidation of these matters, he adds toward the end of his essay, depends on determining the particular nature of time in fate. The fortune teller who uses cards and the seer who reads palms teach us at least that this time can at every moment be made simultaneous with another, not present, end quote. I do not have the time here to draw out all the consequences of these passages for a reading of the images I wish to present to you this evening, but I do wish to emphasize what for me are its most important ones. First, Benjamin suggests that the one who professes to predict fate from signs, and specifically those of the body, never encounters fate directly, since, like character, fate too can be apprehended only in signs, not in itself. The one who reads signs, and here Benjamin points to what characterizes all reading, therefore knows to read them as signs. This means that to have immediate knowledge of fate as such is to read fate in terms of the process of signification itself. Fate, which includes the possibility of predicting the future, is what we come to read and know when we learn to read. Unlike the reader of Kafka's parables, who, as Benjamin tells us in his essay on Kafka, experiences pleasure by smoothing them out so that he has their meaning on the palm of his hand, Benjamin prefers to read significance not on the palm of the hand, where differences are ironed out and everything appears, as it were, in the light of day, but rather in the indelible creases of the palm, whose mysteries are reserved for the skilled chiromancer. In reading the hand, Benjamin suggests, it is necessary not only to trace the palm's furrowed lines, but also and above all to follow the silent writing, the gestural movements of the hands themselves. Second, our fate on encountering a world composed of signs is therefore to learn to read, but to read by understanding that all reading must, like the fortune teller who uses cards and the seer who reads palms, take place, if it can take place at all, in something like a photographic space, a space in which the past, the present, and the future can no longer be thought away from each other, in which the past can appear in what is to come, and what is to come in what is past, and this even if there is no symmetry between the past and the what is to come, and in which ghosts can emerge from the past as well as from the future. Third, in each instance, reading means to be exposed to time, signs, or images. But in regard to the latter, if the reading of images draws us to the necessity of the disappearance into which they withdraw and from which they emerge, as Benjamin tells us elsewhere, what we know we will soon no longer have before us, This is what becomes an image. It is because images themselves, like fate, refer to time. But what we call time is precisely the image's inability to coincide with itself. It demands that every image be an image of its own interruption, that every image be governed by the law that interrupts its surface, that forbids its own presentation. It presents itself as a repetition of the prohibition against images, a repetition that tells us that history can only emerge in the interruption of the continuum of presentation. As Benjamin would have it, without interrupting the historical continuum, without blasting the techniques of representation, there can be no historical time. No history without the interruption of history, no time without the interruption of time, no image without the interruption of the image. If, however, this interrupted image is still an image, then image means the death of the image. It means that every image is an image of death, that the only image that could really be an image would be the one that shows its impossibility, its withdrawal and destruction, its death. 5. In Muslim tradition, if a man fights with his brother, he should spare his face. For God created man after his surah, his image, form, or shape. This tradition links the concept of surah to the prohibition of images, which, like most Muslim institutions, can be traced to the Quran. In Quranic linguistic usage, there is an identification between the concepts of fashioning and shaping and those of making and creating. This is why if God is, according to the Quran, the great fashioner, all human fashioners are imitators of God, and as such, they deserve punishment. Whosoever makes an image, him will God give as a punishment the task of blowing the breath of life into it, but he will not be able to do this. Those who make these pictures will be punished on the day of judgment by being told, make alive what you have created. According to the Sharia, it is forbidden to copy living beings, which is why some of the older jurists say that only what has a shadow is forbidden. In the wording of Al-Judi, however, images without exception are forbidden, which is why for a long time photography was prohibited. And even though this prohibition seems in certain circles to have been overcome, it formed an essential component of the Taliban's fundamentalist iconophobia. It is against the background of this iconophobia that we can begin to register the complexity of the relation between these two photographs and the Muslim prohibition against images. Taken under the sign of the 1996 ban, the very existence of the images works against the prohibition. They come to us in the mode of resistance, a resistance to the erasure of death and devastation, to the repression of death's singularity, to the silence imposed by the prohibition, and to the painful indifference to the suffering of others. They come to us as an injunction to responsibility and to the redemption of the past. For what would freedom be if the dead were not also liberated, at least those who live on in us? And as these photographs suggest, perhaps there are no others. At the same time, produced as they are under the shadow of the prohibition, in secret and at night, the images exist in response to it. They remain in relation to it, even as they seek to overcome it. This contradiction between the resistance to the prohibition and its confirmation, between a hand that seeks to show and a hand that withdraws from monstration, is repeated in the relation between the hands that bear the images of the dead child and brother and the eye of the camera, an eye that cannot be understood here without reference to the Muslim belief in the evil eye. Within Muslim tradition, the deadly effects of the evil eye are generally instigated by a desire to harm that is transmitted by a hateful or envious gaze. But they also can be involuntary and can result from the injurious power of a strange or staring look. If the hand of the one who survives the death of his son or brother is subjected to the eye of the camera, an eye that, as we know, is often said to kill, to petrify, and to annihilate whatever its lens captures, this hand is also what resists the evil eye's most devastating effects. Indeed, the most effective protective symbol against the evil eye is the number 5, Kamsa, and the figuration of the 5 fingers of the hand positioned along with the palm in the direction of the eye. In several Muslim countries, five still possesses a magical value as a defense against the evil eye. And because of this, a popular method of protection against this eye consists essentially in stretching out the hand, along with the fingers, toward the person whose glance can harm, and in pronouncing a formula containing the word Kamsa. This is why the mark of a henna-painted hand, and often a hand with an eye painted in its palm, is also a preferred mode of protection. We also might recall that henna is an auspicious material, since it is thrown on corpses before they are buried. When Fazl Sheikh's photographs present their severed hands, then, they evoke, confirm, and resist a constellation of Islamic beliefs within a medium that has its own controversial history within Islam. These open palm surrenders of images of the dead simultaneously say yes and no to the camera's eye. Look at what my hand offers you, this small image of a dead child and brother, and let others know what you see. Do not look at me in a way that will too quickly lead me to share in my sons and brothers' experiences of death. See the hand you have severed, and know that even in the face of this violence, I will continue to show what I can. See the way in which your eye already has destined me to death, to the mortification, petrification, and thingification that takes place in every photograph. 6. That these two photographs stage an allegory of photography's relation to sight and the indeterminacy from which it emerges, to blindness and the essential withdrawal or death of the photograph, is confirmed by two details of the image on your right. The image of Haji Kamuddin holding the small photograph of his dead brother, Asamuddin. The first detail to which I wish to call your attention is the wounded left eye of the dead brother, a wound that announces, even before his death, his relation to darkness and to the night, his closed lid perhaps already suggesting the process of burial, the closing of the coffin's lid he will soon experience. His other eye, though, the open, staring left one, also resembles an eye of the blind, perhaps even an eye of the dead, at the very moment when mourning begins. It is still open, but we can imagine the hand that will soon come to close it. I mention this because this image of the half-blind dead brother suggests not only the opening and closing of the camera's shutter, but also the opening and closing of vision that is enacted in every photograph. For each time, it is a story of what the eye can see and what it cannot, of what the camera can capture and of what eludes it. To say this, however, is simply to say that our experience of a photograph is always an experience of the eye, of an eye that seeks to see where it does not see, where it no longer sees, or where it does not yet see. At every moment, we are asked to respond to a certain play of light and darkness, and we respond to the muteness of this play by inventing stories, by relating every image to several possible narratives. We will never know, however, if the stories we tell about what we think we see as we look will ever touch or engage the images before us. What happens when a photograph gives the experience of the eye over to darkness, when its lights and shadows prevent us from seeing? What might the experience of blindness have to do with what makes photography photography? In what way does this image tell us that sight is essentially linked to an experience of mourning, an experience of mourning that mourns not only experience, but sight itself? This withdrawal from sight is reinforced in the photograph by the fading of the hand's fingertips, by their withdrawal into the darkness from which they emerged. What withdraws is the hand's capacity to point, to indicate, and refer. This withdrawal, like the withdrawal and death of the brother, deepens the alternation between remembering and forgetting that leaves its traces in the photograph. The fading fingertips evoke a principle of indetermination. The fading away of the possibility of reference does not mean, however, that reference is no longer possible. Rather, like the memory of the dead ones in the images before us, it is always on the point of disappearing without ever disappearing. The images therefore enact an art of perpetual retreat and reference, an art that always announces the withdrawal of the one who is photographed. 7. This is why we might say the image allows us to speak of our death before our death. It already announces our absence. As I have suggested elsewhere, we need only know that we are mortal. The photograph tells us we will die One day we will no longer be here, or rather we will only be here as we have always been here, as images. It announces the death of the photographed. This is why these two photographs also suggest that what survives in a photograph is also the survival of the dead, what departs, desists, and withdraws. And as Benjamin writes in his artwork essay, man withdraws from the photograph. This means that there can be no photograph without the withdrawal of what is photographed. Photographs bring death to the photographed, and because the conjunction of death and the photograph is the very principle of photographic certitude, the photograph is a kind of cemetery. A small funerary monument, it is a grave for the living dead. As Roland Barthes explains, if the photograph bespeaks a certain horror, it is because it certifies that the corpse is alive as corpse. It is the living image of a dead thing, end quote. This is why photography is a mode of bereavement. This bereavement acknowledges what takes place in any photograph, the return of the departed. The return of what was once there takes the form of a haunting, and as Benjamin states in his 1916 essay on the Trauerspiel, the dead become ghosts. It is no accident, therefore, that Haji Kamuddin tells us that when he sleeps, he sees his brother Asamuddin walking in the streets of their home village with his Kalashnikov slung over his shoulder, just as he did when he was alive. It is perhaps precisely in death that the power of the photograph is revealed, and revealed to the very extent that it continues to evoke what can no longer be there. In photographing someone, we know that the photograph will survive him. It begins even during his life to circulate without him, figuring and anticipating his death each time it is looked at. It tells us that there is no life except the life that signifies death. This means that there is no photograph, no image that does not reduce the photographed to ashes. Benjamin goes even further when, in his essay, The Storyteller, he suggests that the reader of images and texts also must be reduced to ashes. In a passage that identifies the reader with flame, the reader is said to annihilate and devour the stuff or subject matter of a novel, as fire does logs in a fireplace. What sustains this reader flame is no longer just wood and ashes, even if these are now transformed into a text, but a question that keeps the reader's interest burning: how to learn that death awaits us. As Benjamin notes, that the meaning of a character's life is revealed only in death means that in order to read, the reader must know in advance that he will share this experience of death. The living reader flame, burning over the logs of the past and the ashes of past experience, learns to read by learning of its mortality. Reading means learning to die. 8. There can be no image that does not emerge from the wounds of time and history, that is not ruined by the loss and finitude with which it takes place, without ever taking place. This means that the image testifies not only to its own impossibility, but also to the disappearance and destruction of testimony and memory. This is why if the history and events sealed within these two photographs call out for memory, and for a memory of the violence and trauma it evokes, the displacement and decontextualization it enacts, this memory could never be a memory that aims to restore or commemorate. If the past is experienced in terms of loss and ruin, it is because it cannot be recovered. Nevertheless, we are still obliged to imagine a means of remembering what remains without remaining, what destroying and consuming itself still demands to be preserved, even if within a history that can never enter into history. We must learn to read the past, to read, that is, the irretrievable images of the past, but in a way that knows how these images threaten to disappear to us as long as we do not recognize ourselves in them. This is why, as the Italian artist Salvatore Puglia has suggested, what remains for us is to collect the fleeting images of what has disappeared, to recollect the floating fragments of this history of disappearance. What remains is the possibility of a gesture, to hand, to hold out, in the scattered memories to which we are condemned, some vestigia, some expressions of a multiple anamnesis, end quote. What remains are the fragments of an image or photograph, perhaps one like these. That's it. Thanks. So, small informal group, we can have questions. Had any of you seen these images before? Yeah. Maybe we can turn.
Switch from the noise off, or if you want to.
It's a miscitation, a kind of a perverted citation of Montaigne, who says to philosophize is to learn to die.
Right.
And it's Montaigne himself citing Socrates.
Right. And that's, I was thinking maybe in the context of Barthes' encounter with the madness of death.
Right.
And he says that this is not a learning process, this is unlearning.
Right.
I think this is what these images suggested to me, that, you know, we have a humanistic illusion that we could learn to die.
Right, right.
And I think they remind us that this is just an illusion. But it's not like my main commentary. More the fact that, and it's really my ignorance possibly, but having seen a number of images from Palestinian camps, I happen to have a brother who's just finished a book and a documentary on these camps, and he's gone twice. And one of the things he showed me was that you have, but maybe they're not really Muslim in the same sense that the Taliban's were or are, you would see the portraits of all the martyrs.
Right.
You know,
right.
And, you know, they were not trying, but they were there.
Right.
And clearly, this is a little bit like my question. Isn't there here something that has to do with something more than just showing the face of the dead person in a situation of tragedy, war, and so on? Also showing something that cannot be shown. Whereas you could take the same kind of the brother who died with his Kalashnikov, if he has somehow acquired the status of the martyr and so on.
Right.
It will remain to be seen whether any kind of Muslim religion applies there. That I don't really know.
Right.
And whether this would not be condemned precisely by the Taliban. But anyway, it seems to me that there are two regimes of, let's say, the way death, or maybe more, but, you know, these remind me more of Aaron's photographs here. Victims who, you know, show themselves but cannot really show themselves, and so on.
Right.
Whereas you could also imagine the propaganda image and, you know, the cult the procession with the two or three coffins and the images on them that we've seen and that are so important right now.
Right.
In the camps and so on.
Right.
Some images of my brother brought back, but absolutely terrifying, given the degree of passion, pathos, violence, you know, that you can, you know, is really going to erupt. It's barely under control all the time for, you know, all the reasons, you know.
Right. I actually think that at a certain level, both of these questions are somewhat related. And I think that my favorite mode of writing these kinds of essays is in theses or little sections.
Yes.
And one of the things that is then required of the listener or the reader and so on is to read these things syntactically in relation to one another. So that this line, to read means learning to die, if put in relation to some of the other comments, which I think have something to do with the way in which the activity of reading, one of the things that it exposes you to is time finitude, etc. That's part of what I meant by learning to die, aside from the citation and so on. But also, there is a way in which, and this is what I think is linked to the second part of the question, I think you're absolutely right that it is about what can be shown and what cannot be shown. And I think that one of the ways in which I was trying to read these images, and especially the one on the right, when the fingertips start disappearing, there is a way in which that introduces a principle of indetermination into the capacity to read, to show, to point, to indicate. And I think that that's something that I wanted to inscribe within this broader meditation of what it would mean to read in general and whether it's possible to read in general. The other thing that I would say, which has to do with the use of the faces of the martyrs and so on, and maybe this is something that was sort of alluded to in the talk quite quickly, is that there was from the very beginning an enormous controversy within Islam about photography and about whether or not one could use photography. And there's the line that I think I cited where you could only produce images of beings who don't produce a shadow. Right? So you can only produce images of the dead. Right? I mean, the ones who are under the ground in some sense. But there is, on the one hand, the use of the image, and as you say, for propaganda and so on. But what struck me within this context was the fact that Fazl had to actually disguise himself. He had to travel with the Northern Alliance, had to take these pictures at night, because of the very fundamentalist dimension of the Taliban prohibition. So that they are the sort of the extreme version of one part of the controversy. But in any case, I think what you're pointing to is something that, again, I tried to weave syntactically throughout the talk, which has to do with what it would mean not simply to read, but also to show what is to be read, right? And so this issue of what it would mean to read these poems and all the passages from Benjamin and Sholem, which talk about the inaccessibility of the poem in some way, against the reader who would experience pleasure in reading the meaning of the parable on the poem, like the light of day. So the gesture, at least, is to suggest that reading is not possible. Does that make sense? Does that answer? It's a difficult thing because I also think that, and I tried to suggest this in the reading of toward the end, when I'm talking about the prohibition and the way in which these hands, which are in some sense the response to the evil eye, you say five in your eye, you put your hand there, try and block, prohibit, it's still a gesture that's made in response to the prohibition. So it's both a confirmation and a resistance to the prohibition. And I think that couple, let's say, of showing, not showing, resisting, confirming, is very much like the couple of seeing, not seeing, reading, not reading, and so on that I try and mobilize through the talk. I don't know if that answers everything, but...
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Yeah.
First of all, it makes me think of the fact that everyone looks at image, that sort of, there isn't, the image is missing, right?
Yeah.
But also I was thinking that the genealogy of sign itself, of the word sign,
right.
In Greek is sema, which is also a tune.
Right.
So there is a way in which reading is always maybe in some sense about a death, or at least it's about the word, what have you. But I guess that this brings up a question for me, which is, can you distinguish in any way between what a sign is and what an image is? Or they aren't the same?
That's a good question. Also, two parenthetical remarks about the initial comments you made. The missing image in the Bart text, of course, is always going to problem for me, because he sort of reads the, and he sees describes the image of his mother when she's young, and as well, and she suggests, that image suggests the essence of motherhood, the essence of his mother in some way. And yet there's this image of this little girl who's not yet a mother. So how can this not yet mother signal the essence of motherhood? But I think that's also linked to Ramasethi. And the other thing,
one of the twists is that he says he can be the father.
Yes, and in fact the mother becomes
becomes the child.
Right.
It's like the virgin.
It's very warm. Yes, virginous.
The paradox is that the virgin who is always the mother and the child of Jesus.
Right.
But,
that helps me. the reading death thing, I guess. I was also trying to play with the idea of palm reading, right? So for palm reading, we usually think about palm reading as something that helps us access the future. You know, there's a rapport to the future in palm reading. And what I was trying to do is use these images and sort of displace the palm reading onto something that would not just be about the future, but also about death and future death. The relation between a sign and an image, I suppose that in the long run, and maybe this is, I would say that there is in order to answer the question, one has to do a kind of long philological account of the ways in which these two words have historically been treated differently and appear in different contexts with different meanings. But I guess the most aggressive thing I would say is that in the long run, I don't make a distinction, which is to say that in order to read a sign and in order to read an image, what I'm arguing is that what one needs to do is read what is not visible in either the sign or the image, which is to say one has to, at some level, begin to read or access, to the extent that one can, all the histories that are sealed within that image or sign. And it's those histories or memories that are sealed within the image or sign that actually, I think, interrupt the surface of both the image and the sign. And I guess I'm more interested in that operation than in trying to distinguish between the sign and image. But maybe you could, do you have a way of...
I'm with the verse on this for the most part. Mm-hmm. If only because I think that he's given such a wonderful definition of the sign as a constellation of singularities that cannot be recognized. In other words, this is sort of counterintuitive, because of course we think that a sign is that which is already sort of, is always an expectation of meaning as opposed to an image, which is not a sign, doesn't, in a sense, point to or indicate. But I think for him, a sign is that which precisely evades meaning.
Right.
Or evades the precise sense of determination.
Right.
And I think that for me is a pretty good sense. That was, and for him, it's obviously sort of tilting towards the question, an aesthetic sign or a sign that emerges, especially in the same
But then you see why, for me, it's hard to distinguish
between
a sign and the image, because the way I'm trying to delineate what an image is has everything to do with the way in which the image always interrupts itself. It's never an image. It's always multiple singularities from these histories, memories, and so on. It's never open. It's never closed.
Yeah.
And so that force of interruption that occurs at the surface of the image is, for me, not unlike what Deleuze would say. It's my problem.
Yeah. No, I think it's his too in some ways.
But it is, part of what I'm trying to do is rework what it would mean to think what an image is, so that the image itself would never produce a meaning in the same way that a sign would never produce a meaning. But at the same time, in the beginning, the opening where the image of death, the image that tries to present death, tells us about the death of the image. And it's not just the end about the death of the image, but also the death of the death of the image. And so I think that tension is part of what I'm trying to explore. And I think that's what would keep me from wanting to distinguish that, while at the same time saying that we do have a different history, these two words, and we have to retract that history in order to answer the question.
Yeah.
Yes, but it changes. I mean, it depends on what.
They're showing the right hand here.
Let's see. There are two different hands. There are two different hands.
They know, but it's not. Is it each time the right hand?
No.
One was the left hand.
One was the left and one was the right.
See, that's why it's complicated. But I mean, if you read, and I've sort of gone through a lot, even terrible books. I mean, there was one called "Your Career in Your Hands." But it's very hard to find really good books on palmistry, you know, because it's very popularized and so on. But there were efforts, and there's a woman whose name escapes me now who was writing in the 40s and 50s. Who actually tries to provide a psychoanalytic understanding of palmistry, and in the long run does readings, actually reproduces photographs of the hands of famous writers and artists, including Benny, and actually does readings of their hands, I mean Man Ray, T.S. Eliot, and so on. It's an extraordinary thing. But she, in that book, she does distinguish between the left hand and the right hand, and which one has to do with the past and the future. She's very, she wants to produce a science of palmistry. Yeah.
Just now, Alice, at the beginning of your talk, you discussed quite a bit the openness of the photograph of Jesus, so causing self-interruption, and also these intricate networks of meanings. But then, as you progressed through your talk, you got the sense, I mean, and it could be another way of reading the motif of self-interruption. A kind of closed circuit of the photograph where it brings death and then at the same time mourns the death that it brings.
Right.
So in a sense it's kind of logically closed. I mean, do you sense this closed? I mean, maybe it's just actually the logic of bereavement where you remember the person alive and then juxtapose it always with the statement, you know, that she is dead.
Right. So you mean closed in terms of this little circle of it represents death, but then it's representing death in order to
produces death. I mean, it's sort of beyond representing it.
So it produces death from death.
And warning. And, basically.
And so that's why it would be a kind of closed circuit.
It produces death and mourns the death that it produces. Do you see that?
I'm sorry, Nancy.
Basically, the photograph. You said something, the photograph brings death to the photograph.
Right, and in fact, there's a way in which one of the things that happens is that there was a moment when I said that, in a certain sense, a photograph turns the photograph, always turns the photograph into a kind of refugee. It decontextualizes, pulls out of the context, tears from the context, whatever it photographs. And in that sense, you could say that the photograph produces a kind of death. Rip something out from the moment in which that thing existed, or that person existed. And then mourn the death, I guess I'm understanding mourning death as almost an overcoming of death. And I'm wondering if that's in keeping with what you're meaning. Or do you mean mourn death or mourning the death?
I would be talking about mourning the death.
Mourning the death, okay. So it produces the death and then also mourns it. That's what you're getting.
Yes, I mean, when you say sort of through mourning it overcomes the death, and since we sort of made reference to Karen Lucy, I feel very much in that book, mourning is this sort of constant repressive act that kind of hems Bath in, like you can't get out of it. Mm-hmm. So it's like it is precisely not an overcoming of death.
I guess when I was talking about the overcoming of death, and I'll try and return to what you're saying, it's linked to the beginning gesture, which is that the image of death, every presentation of death, presents, among other things, the death of the image, of what is trying to do the presentation. So that every image, at some level, evokes its own impossibility. And at the same time, still, within the context of that impossibility, gestures to show. Right? Even if all it can show is its interruption, its breakage, its ruin, and so on. So that what interested me was the way in which the image of death not only seeks to present the death of the image, but the way in which, in trying to present the death of the image, presents, in a certain sense, the death of the image, because it still nevertheless tries to show. So if what you're saying is that, and I'm doing this analogously, is that the image, the photograph, always produces death, it brings death, it also mourns the death of the one who has been brought to death, I think that's true. I think that is true. And that is part of the conjunction that occurs within a photograph. Now, if I were thinking about that as something that closes, I guess I don't think of it as a circuit, because I think what interrupts the circuit is the effort we make to read the image, which then requires linking that image to everything that's invisible in the image, which is to say the history, the image, the history, the memories, and so on. So that one of the things I was trying to, and maybe this is part of what you were saying, that I opened up with a gesture and then in the process of reading the image seemed to suggest something else. But I guess what I was trying to do in the process of the reading of the image was to continue to kind of accumulate all the different things that would have to be brought to bear on the image in order to read it. Right? I mean, not just the sort of immediate, whatever those circumstances would be, the immediate circumstances of this hand showing you the image, which has to do with fossil shake going through the border and taking these images under the telephone band, but also the history that is evoked by that. You know, the Soviet invasion, all that history that is developing in the beginning. So I guess for me, and maybe it wasn't successful, but what I was trying to do was just little by little through the process of the movement of the essay, keep adding and accumulating the associations that I think have to be read in relation to these images as a way of performing the interruption of that image. I mean, how the image cannot be reduced to an image that can be understood immediately, but has to be.
I think we are convergent in that.
Does anybody else have something to say about that? Because
I think what you say to me makes sense and explains why God doesn't want us to read the image of his mother. And I think it's not that he keeps it as a miser,
right,
but he doesn't want it to be read,
right,
by us.
Right.
He can read it, but he doesn't want the second part of the first part, which is the death of the death.
Right.
And so on. He wants to keep it as such, therefore right. It cannot be read by anyone else.
Right.
And I think reading, at least one of the things you showed, I think, is a corrective process.
Yeah.
Even if we may have totally different interpretations, reading is not there. It's not singular corrective.
Right. In fact, that's what I'm trying to performing the citationality, right? So the reading means going to die. It's a citation, so my language is already opening onto other language elsewhere, or history, etc. And that trying to write the text in that way to show what it would mean for me to read. I mean, this is how I would read it, because my reading is filtered by all of these things. There was something else that you said, though, about Bart not wanting us to read the image. The citation from Benjamin when he talks about the danger and peril of reading. And I glossed that as one of the things he's warning against is the danger of having of imagining that we can understand or read or see an image. And I think that would be the same anxiety that Bart would have.
But here, I think,
in
those photographs, it's a photograph of a photograph of an hand, so it's sort of infinite regress of frames and so on.
Right.
One has the background, the other hasn't, but anyway,
we
cannot forget that.
Right.
So it's not like showing directly, you could have just focused on the photograph.
Yeah. And actually, I think that's why it's important to say again that what a photograph gives you is an image. Mm-hmm. But this kind of complicated, but it gives you, it's never what was photographed, which is another way in which the image is interrupted.
Perhaps I wasn't as simplistic enough, but could you speak more about the refugee and in particular say how in the possibility of your portraits, how the portraits relate to death? To me, they're eternally orphans, but they are outside of
like the portraits, I mean, you mean the photograph or the entire, the photograph that's being held or the photograph that is?
Both. They're holding themselves up as orphans in relationship to us, in relationship to their period, right. Both as a commentary on our relationship to photographs from 1945, right. As well as their relationship being now posted in newspapers
right.
To those that might or might not recognize them. But also as photographs, to me they kind of confirm their own kind of dislocation, but not death. It's precisely death that they are now connected to their eternally present, trying to confirm their status as orphans.
Sure. Yeah.
Your show.
The death of the death. You know, I guess what I was doing, I mean, I think these I would have to look at more carefully, but...
So I guess is the argument... specific to these?
It's not specific to these. And I think within the context of this talk, what I was trying to do was, I mean, since these are images of refugees, I was trying to think of a way, and it wasn't so hard, I think, in the end, to think of a way in which the photograph would also tell me something about the refugee, but also the refugee would tell me something about photography. And so there was a way in which, I mean, given that every photograph, I mean, if you want to read a photograph, right, I mean, here's the rule. If you're going to read a photograph, you have to read what's not visible in the photograph. You put that photograph in relation to histories, memories, etc. But you can never just do that, because if you just do that, then you neglect the force of decontextualization that belongs to the structure of the photograph. Like every photograph enacts that decontextualization. And so I was reading that force of decontextualization in terms of the becoming refugee of every photograph, right? So that that's the analogy, that's the link. Talk about the way in which, and in fact, people have talked about this in relation to museums, and we've talked about this before, the way in which works of art that are in museums are orphans, and that the museum is a kind of orphanage because the works of art have been ripped from the context within which they were produced and put into the museum. So that the figures of the refugee and the orphan are quite close, and in fact structurally belong to this meditation on the force of decontextualization. I guess that if I were trying to improvise on these images, and I'd have to know more about, I mean, you told me a little bit about them, but I guess, you know, of course, the one thing that's most immediate is that the photograph reproduces only the face. So it reproduces a kind of fragment of the body. In fact, the body is itself truncated. And that reproduction of the face it is a doubling, and I think that doubling is what you were talking about in terms of a relation to the present. But I guess I do think that it's not so clear to me. If I were to read these images, what you need is to know that history. You have to know what you are saying, that these are children who are putting forward this image in order to... See, I don't think that these images would not have a history.
Could you read them also in the context, the historical context, that you call it?
You can only read them in terms of the historical context, but there is no personal context to be read that they will bring you to.
I think that it's important because, on one hand, what you could then say, and if one were going to push it, then these images become even more emblematic of the photograph in general, precisely because they require you to reconstruct the history, but a history that can never be reconstructed. And in fact, the histories that are associated with these figures are histories that, from the very beginning, have been decontextualized and ripped from the context. I don't think that answers it, but I'd have to look more.
I think that the problem with the question, is the assumption.
Or with the answer.
I think it's a loaded question, because the problem is the assumption that history would be a coherent history, or that it existed apart from our making it or constructing it or imagining it or fabulating it in the first place. And of course, that's the labor of history continuing. It doesn't mean so good about this, understanding that, there's a Heisenberg principle, basically. It's really hard.
I mean, when you sketched out, didn't you date it? You said, did you evoke a date?
I know the date that they're taking on.
But
I guess my question was more if you could, would you could speak on the relationship of the orphans of death and the orphans of the conflict?
Well, I think that the link has to do with the force of digitization, which is a written context, and that is figured and spoken about within debates on photography as a kind of killing. And that's what I was trying to evoke, although I think that in these images it's much easier, of course, to talk about it. There it's much more figural. I mean, to walk through.
No, it's when you get all the papers and so on.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Leave your past behind.